It had taken 150 porters to carry the munitions away, while another 500 porters had each carried a 25-litre drum of avgas. Renamo used mainly women porters, trained since girlhood to carry weights on their heads. That quantity of avgas was sufficient to keep the Hind flying for almost 200 hours, and by then there would be a good chance of capturing a Frelimo fuel tanker, either on the railway line or on one of the roads near the coast that was still open to traffic. However, General China's main concern at that moment was to keep the rendezvous which he had arranged by radio with General Tipu Tip, the commander of Renamo's southern division. "General, I have spotted the village," the pilot spoke in China's earphones. "Ah, yes, I see it," China answered. "Turn towards it, please." As the Hind approached, Sean shifted his perch, creeping behind a densely leafed bough and flattening himself against the branch. Although he knew it was dangerous to turn his face towards the sky, he relied on the bush of his beard and his deep tan to prevent the sun reflecting off his face, and he watched the helicopter avidly. He realized that their ultimate survival depended on being able to elude this monster, and he studied its shape to estimate the view that the pilot and his gunner commanded from behind their canopies. It might be vital for Sean to know the blind spots of the flight engineer and the field of fire of his weapons. He saw the cannon in the remote turret below the nose abruptly traverse left and right, almost as though the gunner were demonstrating them for him. Sean couldn't know that General China was merely gloating on his own power and playing with the weapon controls, but the movement illustrated the Gatling cannon's restricted field of fire. The barrel could only swing through an arc of 30 degrees from lock to lock. Beyond that, the pilot was obliged to swivel the entire aircraft on its own axis in order to bring the cannon to bear. The Hind was very close now. Sean could make out every minute detail of the hull, from the crimson excellent logo on the nose to the rows of rivet heads that stitched the titanium armoured sheets. He looked for some weakness, some flaw in the massive armour. But in the few seconds before she was overhead, he saw that she was impregnable, except for the air intakes to the turbo engines, like a pair of hooded eyes above the upper pilot's canopy. The intakes were screened by debris suppressors, bossed light metal discs that inhibited the dust and debris thrown up by the downdraft of the rotors when the helicopter hovered close to the ground from being sucked into the turbines. However, the debris suppressors were not so substantial as to prevent the Stinger missiles flying clearly into the intakes, and Sean saw that there was a necessary gap around the edge of the metal boss wide enough for a man to stick his head through. At the correct angle and from very close range, an expert marksman might just be able to aim a burst of machine gun fire through the gap so as to damage the turbine vanes. Sean knew that even a chip from one of those vanes would unbalance the turbine and set up such vibrations in the engine that it would fly to pieces within seconds. "A hell of a shot and a hell of a lot of luck," Sean muttered, staring upwards through slitted eyes. Suddenly the light reflected from the armoured glass canopy altered so that he could see into the interior of the cockpit. As he recognised General China, despite the hard plastic flying helmet and the mirrored aviator glasses shielding his eyes, hatred flushed fiercely through Sean's guts. Here was the man on whom he could firmly set the blame for Job's death and all their other woes and hardships. "I want you," Sean muttered. "God, how badly I want you." China seemed to sense the force of his hatred, for he turned his head slightly and looked down directly at Sean's perch, staring at him evenly through the mirrored lens of his sunglasses, and Sean shrank down upon the branch. Then abruptly the Hind banked away, exposing its blotched grey belly. The downdraft lashed the treetop, shaking the branches and throwing Sean about in the hurricane of disrupted air. And Sean realized that it had been an illusion and that China had not spotted him in his treetop bower. He watched the huge machine skitter away on its new heading, and then a few miles distant the engine beat changed, The sound of the rotors whined in finer pitch, and the Hind hovered briefly above the forest and then sank from view. Sean clambered down the tree. Matatu had doused the small cooking fire at the first sound of the Hind's approach, but the canteen of maize porridge had already been cooked through. "We'll eat on the march," Sean ordered. Claudia groaned softly, but pulled herself to her feet. Every muscle in her legs and back ached with fatigue. "Sorry, beautiful." Sean put an arm around her shoulders and squeezed her. "China landed only a mile or two east of here, probably at the village of Dombey. We can be pretty sure he has troops there. We've got to move on." They ate the last handfuls of hot, sticky, salted maize porridge on the march and washed it down with water from the bottles that tasted of mud and algae. "From now on, we are living off the land," Sean told her, "and China is breathing down our necks." The Hind hovered 100 feet above the road that ran through the village of Dombey. It was the only road, and the village was merely a collection of 20 or so small buildings that had been long abandoned. The glass was broken from the window frames, and the whitewashed plaster had fallen from the adobe walls in leprous patches. Termites had devoured the roof timbers, so that the corroded corrugated sheeting sagged from the roof. Those buildings fronting onto the road had all once been small general dealer's stores, the ubiquitous dukas of Africa, owned by Hindu traders. One faded sign hung at a drunken angle, "Patel and Patel," it proclaimed, between the crimson trademarks of the Coca-Cola Company. The road itself was dirt-surfaced and littered with rubbish and debris, weeds growing rankly in the unused ruts. "Take us down," China ordered, and the helicopter sank towards the roadway, lifting a whirlwind thick with dead leaves, scraps of paper, discarded plastic bags and other rubbish. There were men on the veranda of Patel and Patel, and armed men amongst the derelict buildings, 50 or more, all heavily armed and dressed in an assortment of camouflage, military and civilian clothing, the electric uniform of the African guerrilla. The Hind settled to the rutted road, and the pilot throttled back the turbos. The rotor slowed, and the engine noise sank to a low whistle. General China opened the armoured canopy, jumped down lightly to the earth, and turned to face the group of men on the stoop of the general dealer's store. "Tipu Tip," he said, and opened his arms wide in fraternal greeting. "How good to see you again!" He raised his voice above the engine whistle. General Tipu Tip came down the steps to meet him, his own thick arms held wide as a crucifix. They embraced with the utmost insincerity of two fierce rivals who knew that they might one day have to kill each other. "My old friend," said China, and held him at arm's length, smiling warmly and lovingly upon him. Tipu Tip was not his real name. He had taken that as a nom de guerre from one of the most notorious of the old Arab slave traders and ivory runners of the previous century. However, the name and its associations suited him to perfection, China thought, as he looked down upon him. Here stood a rogue and brigand cast in the classic mould, a man to admire and to treat with great caution. He was short, the top of his head on a level with China's chin, but everything else about him was massive. His chest was like that of a bull gorilla, and his thick arms hung in similar fashion, so his knuckles were at the level of his knees. His head was like one of those gigantic Rhodesian granite boulders balanced on the pinnacle of a rocky koppie. He had shaven his pate, but his beard was a thick mattress of woolly black curls that hung onto his chest. The forehead and nose above it were broad, and his lips full and fleshy. He wore a gaily coloured strip of cotton cloth bound around his forehead, while a gillet of tanned cuckoo hide over his naked torso was opened down the front to expose his chest. His chest was covered with black peppercorns of wool, and his naked arms protruding from the short sleeves were thick and roped with muscle. He smiled back at China, and his teeth were brilliant as mother-of-pearl, in contrast to the smoky yellow whites of his eyes, laced with a network of veins. Your presence has perfumed my day with the scent of mimosa blossom, he said in Shangani. But his eyes slid past China's face and returned to the huge helicopter from which he had disembarked. Tipu Tip's envy was so unconcealed that China felt he could smell it and taste it like burning sulphur in the air. The machine had altered the fine trim and balance of the relationship between these two most powerful of all the Renama warlords. Tipu Tip could not keep his eyes off it. It was obvious that he wanted to examine it more closely, but China took his arm and led him back towards the shade of the veranda. The pilot had not killed the engines, and as China and his host stepped out of the circle of the rotors, he gunned the hind and pulled on his collective. The great machine rose and turned away. Tipu Tip twisted out of China's grip and shaded his eyes to watch it. His smoked yellow eyes were as hungry as though he were watching a beautiful naked woman performing an obscene act. China let him yearn after it until it passed out of sight. He had sent the hind away purposely because he knew and understood Tipu Tip. He knew that if the machine had remained, the temptation might have become too strong for him to resist, and treachery was as natural to both of them as breathing was to other men. The hind was China's joker, his wild card. Tipu Tip shook himself and laughed for no apparent reason.
They told me that you had destroyed a squadron and captured one of those. And I said, China is a lion among men, and he is my brother. Come, my brother, China agreed. It is hot in the sun.
There were stools ready for them on the veranda in the shade, and two of Tipu Tip's young women brought them clay pots of beer, thick as gruel and refreshingly tart. The girls were both in their teens, pretty little things with eyes like fawns. Tipu Tip liked women and always surrounded himself with them. It was one of his weaknesses, China thought, and smiled a cold, superior smile. He himself could take a boy or a girl with equal enjoyment, but only as a brief diversion and not as a necessity of life, and the women engaged his attention for only a fleeting moment before he turned back to his host. The bodyguards had retired out of earshot, and Tipu Tip waved the girls away.
"And you, my brother," China asked, "how goes the battle? I hear that you have taken the head of Frelimo and pushed it down between their knees to give them a close-up view of their own fundament. Is that true?"
It was not true, of course. As commander of the southern division of Renamo, Tipu Tip was closer to the capital and port of Maputo, which was the centre of government power. He was therefore more prejudiced by the withdrawal of South African military assistance, and he stood in the front line of Frelimo counterattacks and reprisals. China knew that in the last few months Tipu Tip had experienced heavy reprisals and lost many men and much territory in the south. But now Tipu Tip chuckled and nodded.
"We have eaten everything that Frelimo has sent against us, swallowed them without a belch or a fart."
They sparred lightly over the beer pots, smiling and laughing, but watching each other like lions over a kill, on guard and ready at any instant to pounce or defend themselves, until at last China murmured,
"I am pleased to hear that all goes so well with you. I had come to see if my hind gunships could assist you against Frelimo."
He spread his hands in a deprecating gesture.
"But I see you have no need of help from me."
It was a Machiavellian ploy, and China watched as the point slid through Tipu Tip's guard and his expression changed. China knew that it would have been a serious tactical error to ask a man like this for assistance. Tipu Tip had the nose of a hyena to smell out weakness. Instead, China had offered the bait of the hind, dangled it for an instant before his eyes, and then with a crafty sleight of hand made it disappear again. Tipu blinked, and behind his grin he searched for a response. He also hated to admit failure or weakness to one who he knew would exploit it ruthlessly, but still he craved and lusted after that fabulous machine.